the Caribbean was never just a vacation destination. It was always a bridge. In the 1970s, that bridge became a conveyor belt for a new kind of commodity. It started with burlap sacks of marijuana tossed into the holds of fishing boats. It ended with white powder and the total collapse of institutional trust. We are looking at a time when a single shipment of cocaine held more value than the annual gross domestic product of a small island nation. This is not a story of glamorous outlaws. This is a record of how sovereign borders were erased by greed. It is the history of how our waters were turned into a highway for a global poison. We must face the reality of the 1980s. We must look at the men who sat in air-conditioned offices and signed away the safety of their will. People for a wire transfer. The price of that corruption is still being paid today. Chapter 1. The Transit Point. The geography of the Caribbean is a map of convenience for a smuggler. Thousands of Ks, hidden inlets, short hops between landmasses that allow a small plane to skip across the sea without ever needing a long-range fuel tank. In the early 1970s, the trade was green. It was bulky. Marijuana flowed from the hills of Jamaica and the coasts of Colombia. It required large boats and slow movements. But the market in the north was changing. The demand for cocaine was rising, and the old routes through Mexico were under pressure. The traffickers needed a staging ground. They needed a place where the law stopped at the shoreline. They found it in the Bahamas. Carlos Leder was a man who understood logistics and the power of a bribe. He did not want to hide in the shadows. He wanted to own the light. By 1978, he had settled on Mormon's Cay. It was a small, hook-shaped piece of land in the Exumas. It had a runway, had clear views of the turquoise water. Leder did not just move in. He took over. He chased away the residents. He brought in armed guards and German shepherds. He turned a quiet island into a high-speed distribution center. This was the birth of the modern transit point. The operation was a machine. Planes would arrive from Colombia loaded with cocaine. The product was moved into refrigerated warehouses. Then, small, fast planes would fly it into the southern United States. They flew low to avoid radar. They used the hundreds of other islands as cover. But you cannot run a private military base in a sovereign country without help. The silence of the local authorities was a line item on the balance sheet. This is where the rot began. The money was too much for a small economy to ignore. It did not just go to the men on the docks. It went to the top. Our history shows that when the money is this large, the state becomes a partner. In the Bahamas, the 1980s opened with a cloud of suspicion over the highest offices. Commissions of inquiry would later reveal a system of payoffs that reached deep into the cabinet. It was called the windfall. Police officers looked the other way while crates were unloaded in broad daylight. Customs officials developed a sudden inability to count. The sovereignty of the Bahamas was being sold by the kilo. This was not a secret to the people living there. They saw the new cars, and they fled, but not known. They saw the sudden wealth of men who had never worked a day in the sun. The impact on the local community was immediate and devastating. When a transit point is established, the product does not just pass through. It leaks. Some of the cocaine was used as payment for local help. A country that had no history of hard drug use suddenly found itself in the middle of an epidemic. The social fabric of the outer islands began to fray. The young men who used to fish or work in tourism were now part of the logistical chain. They were lookouts. They were muscle. They were becoming addicts. Leder's reign on Norman's Cay was a slap in the face to regional security. He acted as if he were the head of a state. He dropped leaflets over Nassau. He flaunted his wealth. He proved that if you have enough cash, you can buy a kingdom in the middle of the Atlantic. But the arrogance of the transit point was creating a new kind of heat. The United States was losing patience. The pressure on the Bahamian government to act was reaching a breaking point. The white gold was no longer just a business. It was a political liability that threatened to sink the entire administration. The transition from marijuana to cocaine changed the stakes of crime in the Caribbean forever. A boatload of weed could make a man rich. A planeload of cocaine could buy a government. The violence followed the money. The stakes were higher, and the tolerance for failure was zero. As the 1970s faded into the 1980s, the Caribbean was no longer a collection of independent nations. It was a contested zone. The lines between the law and the outlaw were disappearing in the spray of the offshore powerboats. The question was no longer if the drugs would pass through. The question was how much of the Caribbean would be left standing when they did. The infrastructure of the trade was now permanent. The runways were built, The bank accounts were open. The officials were on the payroll. The bridge was open, and the traffic was only getting heavier. The era of the small-time smuggler was over. The era of the narco-state had arrived. By the time the authorities finally moved on Norman's Cay, the model had already been copied. The trade was too big for one island. It was moving into the bloodstream of the entire region. The greed had created a vacuum that was sucking in every institution it touched. The worst was yet to come. The money was about to move from the docks into the banks, and from the banks into the ballot boxes. The silence on the quay was broken by the sound of rotors, but the business had already moved elsewhere. Chapter 2. The Institutional Rot. As the 1980s progressed, the scale of the trade moved beyond isolated islands. It became an institutional reality. The cocaine trade was no longer just about fast boats and daring pilots. It was about ledger sheets and offshore accounts. The Caribbean became the world's counting house for dirty money. This was the era of the suitcase. Thousands of them, filled with $20 bills, moving through regional airports and into the vaults of banks that asked no questions. In many islands, the banking sector was the only part of the economy that was growing. But it was a hollow growth. The money wasn't being invested in schools or hospitals, it was being laundered and sent back out to Europe and North America. This created a parasitic relationship. The banks needed the traffickers to stay liquid, and the traffickers needed the banks to stay clean. Our institutions were being turned into tools for criminal enterprise. When the bank manager is in debt to the cartel, the law is just a suggestion. The rot was not limited to the financial sector. The security forces were the next to fall. In countries like Haiti, the military became the primary facilitators of the trade. Under the rule of various juntas and strongmen, the national airport in Port-au-Prince became a secure terminal for the Medellin and Cali cartels. Officers in the Haiti National Intelligence Service were not just taking bribes. They were managing the shipments. They used their uniforms to protect the very thing they were sworn to stop. This created a terrifying environment for the average citizen. If you had a grievance against a trafficker, you could not go to the police. The person behind the desk was often the same person providing security at the landing strip. The state had ceased to function as a protector. It had become a competitor in the criminal market. This erosion of trust is a wound that takes generations to heal. When the people see their leaders getting rich off the destruction of their youth, the social contract is shredded. The 1980s surge also brought a change in how power was projected. The traffickers began to fund political campaigns. It was an insurance policy. By placing their own people in parliament, they could ensure that extradition treaties were never signed and that police budgets were kept low. The Caribbean was witnessing the birth of the shadow government. These were men who held no official title but could command the movement of entire police divisions with a single phone call. In Jamaica, the situation took an even more political turn. The drug trade became intertwined with the existing system of political garrisons. These were neighborhoods where a specific political party held total control, enforced by armed groups. In the 70s, these groups fought over ideology and votes. In the 80s, they fought over turf and transshipment routes. The Don emerged as a figure who was part community leader, part political enforcer, and part drug kingpin. The flow of guns into the region increased to match the flow of drugs out. The trade was an exchange. Cocaine went north, firearms came south. The Caribbean was becoming one of the most heavily armed regions in the world per capita. The violence was no longer a byproduct of the trade. It was the primary method of regulation. Without a legal court system to settle disputes, the gun was the only judge. The homicide rates began their climb, a climb that has not yet peaked in many of our islands. We must speak plainly about the role of external powers during this time. The Cold War was still raging. In many cases, the intelligence agencies of the North were willing to overlook the drug activities of their local allies as long as those allies were anti-communist. This duplicity added another layer of cynicism to the region. The Caribbean was a chessboard where the pawns were being poisoned and the players were looking the other way. The institutional rot meant that even when a big bust occurred, it rarely led to a conviction. Files went missing, witnesses disappeared, judges were threatened or bought. The system was rigged to protect the high-level players, while the low-level, mules, filled the prisons. This created a permanent underclass of the incarcerated, mostly young men from the poorest neighborhoods, who were used as disposable labor by the cartels and the corrupt elite. By the late 1980s, the Caribbean was under siege from within. The very structures meant to ensure independence and sovereignty were being used to undermine them. The wealth being generated was a ghost. It built mansions behind high walls, but it left the streets in ruins. The economy was addicted to the white gold, and the withdrawal was going to be violent. The pressure was mounting. The international community was finally taking notice of the scale of the corruption, but as the net began to tighten, the players on the ground became more desperate. The stakes were no longer just about money. They were about survival. The shadows were getting longer, and the dons were ready to defend their empires. Chapter 3. The Heavy Toll. The 1990s brought the bill for the excesses of the previous decade. The don system in Jamaica had matured into a parallel state. In neighborhoods like Tivoli Gardens, the central government had almost no presence. The local leader provided the jobs. He provided the school fees. He provided the justice. But this was a system built on the profits of the international drug trade. When the state finally tried to reassert control, the result was not a police action. It was a war. The legacy of the 1980s is the normalization of the Shota culture. The violence that was once a tool of the trade became a cultural identity for a lost generation. The music of the time reflected this. It recorded the reality of the garrisons and the power of the gun. But we must be careful not to mistake the record for the cause. The cause was a systematic failure of leadership that allowed criminal economies to replace legitimate ones. The cost to the community is best measured in the faces of the victims. Not just those caught in the crossfire, but the mothers who lost their sons to addiction, and the children who grew up in the shadow of the M16. The Caribbean was left with a legacy of trauma that has never been fully addressed. We talk about the money that flowed through, but we rarely talk about the mental health crisis it left behind. The crack epidemic of the late 80s and 90s devastated our urban centers, turning vibrant communities into ghost towns. Foreign intervention also became more aggressive. The war on drugs brought United States military and DEA assets into our waters on a scale not seen since World War II. This created a new kind of tension. Our sovereignty was once again being compromised, this time in the name of security. Shipwrighter agreements allowed foreign vessels to pursue suspects into our territorial waters. It was a necessary move for some, but for others, it felt like a return to colonial times. The environmental toll was also significant. Smugglers would often dump their cargo when pursued, leading to square grouper, bales of drugs, washing up on shores, and poisoning local ecosystems. Secret landing strips were carved into protected forests. The natural beauty of the region, its greatest legitimate asset, was being scarred by a trade that cared for nothing but the next delivery. As we moved toward the year 2000, the routes began to shift back toward Mexico and Central America. The Caribbean route became more difficult and more expensive, but the structures remained. The corrupt officials did not disappear. They just found new things to sell. The dons did not retire. They diversified. The ghost of the 1980s cocaine boom still haunts every election and every budget meeting in the region. We are left with a fundamental question. How do we rebuild the institutions that were so easily bought? The answer is not found in more guns or more prisons. It is found in the slow, difficult work of restoring the social contract. It is found in transparency and the protection of the whistleblowers. It is found in an education system that offers our youth a path that doesn't involve a suitcase or a lookout post. Our history is not just a list of crimes. It is a record of survival. Even in the height of the narco era, there were honest cops. There were judges who could not be bought. There were journalists who risked their lives to tell the truth. They are the reason we still have a foundation to build on. They are the heroes of this dark chapter, often unnamed and unrewarded. The Caribbean is still a bridge, but the traffic has changed. We are now fighting the consequences of 40 years of being the world's transit point. The money is gone, but the scars remain on our maps and in our families. We must own this part of our story, not to celebrate it, but to ensure that our sovereignty is never for sale again. The price of the white gold was always too high. The tide is coming in, and it is washing over the old runways. But underneath the sand, the concrete is still there. Would you like me to develop a specific episode on the rise and fall of a particular Caribbean don, or should we move to a different pillar like food and survival?